We are talking with Ron Johnson, Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate here at the Wisconsin Radio Network. Ron, welcome.
Well, good morning, Bob. Thanks for having me.
We took a little time before we started here to compare notes, but maybe I'll just have you give me the quick thumbnail biography of Ron Johnson.
Well, I grew up in Minneapolis, and I've worked all my life. I mean, literally from shoveling snow and mowing lawns and caddied paper out. Both my parents grew up on farms. All my aunts and uncles were farmers, so in the summertime, I'd go down to the farms and milk cows and do chores, baled hay, that type of thing. At the age of 15, I got my first job at Walgreens Grill as a dishwasher, rose through the ranks, soda jerk, night manager. It was kind of one of the stories I like to tell is I started out at Walgreens at $1.45 an hour, and when they made me a night manager, they increased my pay to $1.60 an hour. And I was thinking, all right, they've really recognized my achievement. A couple months later, I found out that, no, that was just an increase in the minimum wage. So kind of shrunk my head down. But, I worked all my way through college, went to the University of Minnesota, and I had an opportunity in 1979 to move to Wisconsin to help start up a business. And that's the business I've been building for the last 31 years. It's called Packer. We extrude plastic sheet primarily for medical device packaging. But I gave you that little souvenir card there, lenticular. It's a specialty printing application. All of our products are specialty enough that we actually export the products around the world to about 25 different countries, and China is actually one of our largest export markets. So that's my basic background. I've been married to my wife, Jane, for 33 years, three adult children. All three of them went to UW-Madison, had a very good time going down to UW-Madison here. So that's kind of the thumbnail sketch of my background.
And Packer employs roughly how many people?
About 120 people right now.
Okay. And obviously you've got suppliers who are employed as well by working
with
Packer. Would it be fair to say that it was the whole healthcare reform process that really energized you to get into the race?
Oh, it was. I mean, that was the final straw. Certainly I've been sitting here watching out of control spending as well, and being frustrated by really how poisonous our politics have gotten, how we're simply not addressing these problems. But the final straw was that when they passed a health care bill, and my own personal story there, Bob, is my first child, my daughter Carrie, was born with a very serious congenital heart defect. And she was saved, but it's not a perfect system, but still the finest health care system in the world. And I certainly recognize what this health care bill is designed to do. I mean, it is designed to lead to a single-payer, Canadian-style, British-type system. And, obviously, Senator Feingold, that's exactly what he wants. I have no idea why anybody would want to move in that direction. I mean, Canada and Britain are actually trying to privatize part of their healthcare system so that it can actually serve the public. So, those types of systems will lead to rationing. It's the only way the government control costs is they'll start rationing care, particularly for the elderly and for very sick individuals. So it'll ration care, it will lower the quality of care. And, I sell into the medical device industry. I mean, I realize it is America where medical miracles are created. I mean, America creates the life-saving new drugs, life-saving new medical devices and surgical techniques. And that's what's at risk. In a government-run system, we will not have that medical innovation. And quite honestly, America medical innovation, the rest of the world feeds off it. Their socialistic medicine systems take advantage of the medical innovation that we create here in America. So that's really what's at risk.
What's the healthcare reform going to mean to you and other Wisconsin employers, do you think?
Well, certainly it's not going to accomplish what it was designed to accomplish. I mean, what was the design? It was supposed to lower costs. There's nothing in here that lowers costs. When President Obama made the claim that it was going to save the average family $2,500, in fact, CBO has now come out with a study. The cost of health care will increase by $2,100 per family. It's to a certain extent, it's a redistribution of health care from the elderly because it's going to rob Medicare $500 billion. It's also going to increase taxes by about $500 billion. So it is not going to accomplish what it set out to do. And that's a shame because I think with some very modest market-based solutions, it wouldn't have cost the government anything. We could have moved this health care reform in the right direction. Things like malpractice reform. As I go around the state and I talk to more and more doctors, I mean, they certainly understand that, the couple hundred billion dollar figure that is quoted frequently in terms of the cost of defensive medicine, they think that's an underestimate. So we could have done that. We certainly could have allowed individuals to purchase health care across state lines. That'd be a market-based solution. Doesn't cost the government anything. Those types of bills could have been written just a few pages. Another thing that's really pretty interesting is an awful lot of people are starting to take a look at outcome-based billing versus procedure-based billing. What do I mean by that? For example, there's an institute in Philadelphia or Pennsylvania, the Geisinger Institute, and they're starting to bill a fixed sum for heart bypass. So all the burden's on them to make sure they do a very good, high-quality job, make sure that the patients don't have infection, make sure they do it right the first time. And there are some pretty noted experts. One of them is Richard Elliott. I think he works with the Dartmouth Institute. He's estimated that if we go to outcome-based billing, we could save 20 to 25% of our total healthcare bill. That would save us $500, $600 billion. So it's a real shame. I think we had the national momentum to do real healthcare reform, and I think we just blew it. And we could have moved in market-based solutions, and I think that's what we need to do. I'm totally dedicated to repealing this healthcare bill and then replace it with those very common-based or common-sense market-based solutions.
Well, taxes and spending, on your website, one of your positions says, liberals in Congress planning to spend an additional $3.6 trillion in the next federal budget, money you maintain and that we don't in fact have. So as a senator, what's Ron Johnson's, I guess, plan to scale back federal spending and wasteful federal
sure.
spending?
I mean, I always refer to it, we have a systemic spending problem, which is going to require a systemic solution. We have got to provide an overall cap, an overall discipline to federal spending to force the politicians in Washington to actually prioritize spending, to live like a family budget, to live within their means. So how do you accomplish that? I mean, there are a number of different ways, and I'm open to any of these, but something like a balanced budget amendment, or Mike Pence is a congressperson from Indiana. He's proposed an amendment that would limit the size of government, the size of federal spending to 20% of GDP. One thing a lot of states do is they limit the growth in spending to the increase in population plus the rate of inflation. Had we just done that very simple discipline back as recently as 2000, when our federal budget was $1.8 trillion, we'd be looking at a federal budget today of about $2.5 trillion, about $1.2 trillion less than it is. It'd be close to being balanced. So that's, to me, we have got to provide that overall cap, and a very hard cap, something that the politicians will have to live within. And then underneath that, I mean, that's when the political fighting is going to occur, and it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy. It's going to be hard.
And I wanted to ask you, AP story today, $5 billion in taxpayer dollars wasted in Iraq. Now, this was this was taxpayer money as opposed to the Iraqi oil revenues, and a lot of these contracts obviously awarded to U.S.-based firms that are located in states that are going to be represented by your potential future colleagues. So, the cap, that's great. But when it comes to that horse trading and programs or contracts that maybe your colleagues are going to consider sacred cows, how do we accomplish that in that day-to-day reality of trying to get a reasonable budget?
Well, it's one of the reasons I talk about taking a different perspective to Washington. I've been operating in the private sector for 31 years, operating a business. And again, we have got to live within our means. We can't spend more than we bring in. So what does business do in order to live within their means? They do things like zero-based budgeting. When their costs get out of control, let's say they lose a big customer and they've got to rein in costs. I mean, they have to shut down departments. As painful as it is, nobody likes to see it, they actually have to lay off workers in order for their business to survive. We're kind of at that point in our country. We have got to make some hard choices. We just simply cannot continue to spend money we don't have and run up this level of debt. It's bankrupting our country, and we can see what the result of that is. We can take a look at what's happening to Greece, to Spain, to Italy. This is not going to be pretty. We had better take this serious, and we need to address this problem now.
Reducing the size of government.
Correct.
Reducing the number of people who work for government.
If that's what it takes. Certainly you can do this through attrition. You'd start there. How about a hiring freeze? How about spending freezes? When I'm talking about zero-based budgeting, I'm asking every department to go from ground level and analyze everything they're spending money on and go, what don't we need to do anymore? And let's face it, the federal government is huge. There are so many different layers of bureaucracy, and I would argue it makes the government very ineffective. To use a business-based example, my business is, I would consider it a small to medium-sized business. When we have a product that competes with a large business, I mean, it's very easy for us. we're so much more nimble, so much more effective from a standpoint of customer service than a large bureaucratic corporation, quite honestly. And I would use that as an analogy to large government as well. It's just huge. There's so many different layers. It's not like we lack regulation. We just lack effective regulation because of the size, because of the number of different layers.
Government could take lessons from small to medium-sized businesses.
Absolutely. That's the kind of perspective I would take. And, if, you know, what I really, as I've been going around the state, and literally I think we just got the count of I've done over 350 events. I've visited over 150 cities and towns. I think I'm up to 54 counties. I'd like to get all to 72 before this campaign's over. But certainly what I've been doing is I've been kind of treating it as a job interview. I mean, that's my experience. You know, of course, I've interviewed a lot more people than I've myself been interviewed over 31 years. But I'm just talking about this is what my experience is. This is my background. I'm an accountant. And I think it really was the vision of the founding fathers, you know, to have citizen legislators, you know, people that have had a full life, you know, had a full career, raised a family, and take that body of experience, you know, that lifetime of experience, take that to the nation's capital and apply that to the nation's problems in a common sense approach. I mean, I think people get it. We just have lost common sense in Washington. I don't understand why. I mean, we just have seemed to have lost rational thought. I do not think it's rocket science. I think it's going to be hard. It's going to be political, you know, it's going to be hard political fighting. But, you know, certainly one of the things I bring to the table too is I've been, you know, doing an awful lot of volunteer work in Oshkosh for the last 10 years. One of the things I did was I was the business co-chair of the Partners in Education Council of the Chamber. And the history of that is one of the other co-chair would be the school superintendent. But my first year of experience, I realized it's really kind of a three-legged stool. And teachers need to be involved as well. So what I did is I asked the head of the teachers union to be the other co-chair. So we had a three-person co-chair. Now, politically, the head of the teachers union and myself are pretty night and day. But that never entered the equation. I mean, we were talking about what can we do to improve education for our kids. And I had a great deal of respect for Len, and I hope he had the same level of respect for myself. And we actually did make improvements. We brought life skills training. We brought the financial literacy requirement to the school board. So it requires people of goodwill, people there who are dedicated to actually addressing these problems, trying to solve the problems, and I think we can get it done. But it is going to take bipartisan action, but it takes that type of experience in the real world to go and actually solve problems.
Let's talk about job creation. And you're a free market guy. Government doesn't create jobs; the market creates jobs. But I want to kind of ask you, how do we deal with the deep kind of endemic unemployment that we have in southeastern Wisconsin? I want to cite you some numbers. You're probably somewhat familiar with unemployment rates in southeastern Wisconsin. According to the UW-Milwaukee Center for Economic Development, the unemployment rate in metro Milwaukee among black men ages 16 to 65 is 47.1, 22.1 for Hispanics, and 18.1 for white males. And that is a situation that in many respects precedes our current economic downturn, as the jobs, the good-paying, family-sustaining jobs, have left metro Milwaukee, left southeastern Wisconsin. So what does Ron Johnson propose to turn that around and to bring, you know, not just retaining jobs, but bringing jobs back?
Sure. Well, first of all, number one, we have to create an attractive environment for business creation, for job creation. And we don't have that right now. And I mean, you're talking a little bit of a state issue.
Sure, sure.
But it applies to the federal government as well. I mean, mm-hmm. We're in a global economy. Let's just talk about youth. As I'm traveling around the state, you're talking to farmers. They're having a hard time finding workers. You know, now, are those the most desirable jobs? I certainly did it. I think it's a very good level of experience. You know, get out there and work on a farm. So from a state level, I would like to see some mechanism to bring those, you know, the hardcore teen unemployment, bring those folks to Wisconsin farmers and solve that solution. That's just one, you know, mini solution. But again, the overall solution is we've got to create an attractive environment for job creation. And that involves benchmarking. Again, another business practice. So the state's got to benchmark its tax rates, its regulatory environments. And you're talking about things like combined reporting that's driving businesses out of Wisconsin. I've certainly talked to corporations that just simply are not, I mean, they don't even consider coming to Wisconsin because of the business climate. The same thing's true of America. I don't know that I'd encourage people to go onto YouTube and type in Steve Wynn. He does about a 5-minute piece where he's talking about, he's the fellow that does Wynn Resorts in Las Vegas. He's also creating resorts in Macau, in China, communist China. And his point is the level of uncertainty, the climate for business investment is far more certain in communist China than it is in the U.S. here. I think we have created such a high level of uncertainty in this economy because, quite honestly, because of the agenda that Senator Feingold represents. You know, what do they do? When they first came into office, rather than really attack the economic problem, they spent the first year plus trying to take over 1/6 of the economy, the health care bill. That all that did is increase the level of uncertainty and made it more difficult for this economy to get moving again.
Ron, but Macau is in China. China is a socialist planned economy. The level of uncertainty, isn't the level of uncertainty part of a side effect, if you will, of our democracy, of the continuing horse trading, if you will, the partisan back and forth? That uncertainty, it seems to me, is a byproduct of that. We've had, Democratic and Republican administrations in the White House. We've had Democratic and Republican control of Congress. With that sort of partisan politics, doesn't certainty for business, isn't that a harder hurdle to clear than it is in a place like China?
Well, again, you have to take a look at the overall agenda. You know, I come from the viewpoint that it is the private sector that creates jobs. And if you can get government out of the way, if you can, reduce the level of taxation. And again, I'm not anti-government, I'm not anti-regulation, but let's have effective regulation. Let's have regulation that doesn't get in the way of job growth. That's the direction we have to move versus the direction Senator Feingold is really pushing us is more government intervention, takeover of 1/6 of the economy. I mean, the financial regulation bill, I would argue that the cause of the financial collapse really was the housing bubble. It burst. And I believe that was a creation of Washington, quite honestly. In this financial regulation bill, 2,300 pages, I mean, just first of all, think about 2,300 pages. It created 243 new rules that have yet to be written. Now, those rules would be written by unelected bureaucrats. So, again, that creates a high level of uncertainty, but it didn't even address Fannie and Freddie. It did not address the root cause of that problem. And that's really not what you do in business. When something goes wrong in a manufacturing plant, you try and figure out what is the root cause, and you fix that. You don't do 1,500 other things. You go and address the root cause, and they didn't do that.
I want to move on to energy policy. You say that you think we can responsibly exploit our resources and deal with our energy shortfalls or our energy needs that way. Tell me a little bit about what are your thoughts on alternative energy development and nuclear power? What direction do we need to go in towards energy self-sufficiency in this country?
Well, sure. First of all, I'm a big proponent of actually moving forward with nuclear power. I mean, I think both France and Japan derive 80% of their power from nuclear power, and they do it safely. It's also an industry that we've lost in America because we stopped building nuclear plants. We should get that back. But we do need to recognize we're an oil-based, fossil fuel-based economy, and we're going to be that way for decades to come. I've got a great deal of faith in American ingenuity, American technology. Get to the root cause of what happened with the BP oil spill, correct it. I'm certainly a supporter of drilling in Anwar. Again, doing it from an environmentally safe and sensitive way. I'm a huge environmentalist. I mean, I'm an outdoorsman, primarily a fisherman. I love a pristine environment. I love going out to the mountains and hiking. I get my well water from a well. I don't want to see groundwater contamination. So we can do this in an environmentally sensitive way, but we need to recognize really that we are an oil-based economy, and we've got to drill where the oil is, and that's in the Gulf, and it's up in Anwar, and we need to exploit those resources.
You kicked over a hornet's nest recently with some comments about global warming. I just want to ask you, I mean, are you the sort of person who can take a closer look at evidence and come back later and say, I've looked at the evidence And I'm willing to change my thinking a little bit. Not necessarily say, oh, we need, and so we need to, I'm not expecting Ron Johnson to say, you know, I'm in favor of cap and trade, but to look at the evidence of global warming and perhaps reconsider.
Oh, first of all, absolutely I look at evidence. And that's the problem is I don't think the people on the other side have looked at the alternate, you know, the other evidence as well. I think they've closed their mind because they're on a quest to, again, control the economy. Because they want a tax. Don't ask me why. They want a tax business. They want that revenue so they can control things. But, you know, I think the jury's still out. And because I believe that the science is unsettled in terms of global warming, I think it would be tragic to tax the economy up to another $1 trillion. I mean, how is that going to help us grow? That's going to cripple our economy. And you also need to recognize India and China certainly aren't going to be following suit. And again, we're in a global economy. We have to compete with these folks. That's what I'm talking about. We've got to have an attractive investment environment. We've got to benchmark about what other countries are doing. But no, the science on global warming is not settled. We simply cannot afford to, you know, implement something like a cap and trade, and particularly in Wisconsin here. You know, there have been studies. If we would do something like that, it'd cost an estimate about $1,600 per family in increased energy costs. There have been studies that say it costs us 40,000 to 60,000 additional jobs here in Wisconsin. That'd be real tragic. It's the wrong way to go.
Immigration reform, you're a proponent of real ID. Tell me how that ought to work and why whatever sort of safeguards we have in place now aren't working.
Well, first of all, I'm a proponent of sealing and securing our border. We have to do that. That's the first step we have. You know, we have to do that as well as we should be enforcing the law against employers that are enticing, you know, people over the borders illegally. But the caveat you put to that enforcement is employers, and I'm a business person,
right.
Employers need a safe haven. They need to be able to rely on some system, whether it's Real ID, whether it's E-Verify. I mean, really, I don't take a position on which versus the other. But employers need that safe haven that if they, in good faith, do their due diligence to actually verify somebody's status, they're not going to be prosecuted later on that if they have somebody that's not in the country legally. So that's the only point I'm trying to make there. You know, exactly what system we can use on that, I'm open to one that's actually one that works, one that's actually effective. And quite honestly, one that hopefully provides a little bit more security for border control, for airlines, that type of thing as well.
I want to wrap up and talk about agriculture. You're a manufacturing guy, but agriculture is still a huge part of Wisconsin's economy. In terms of looking at costs and reining in the size of government, agricultural subsidies, I mean, Wisconsin farmers arguably are not receiving the sorts of massive agricultural subsidies that a lot of grain farmers are, especially out west, but willing to look at subsidies in terms of bringing government into check?
Well, first of all, let's talk about the Wisconsin farm economy. It does represent about $60 billion of Wisconsin's economy. It's about 12 to 13%. It's an extremely important sector, and I realize that. I mean, you know, actually, as I mentioned before, I understand the farm.
Sure.
Farm tradition, it's a wonderful tradition. It's good for people to participate in that. As I've gone around the state, obviously my business background is in plastics, so, you know, understanding the full business of farming is what I've been trying to do over the last couple of months. But the first thing you find out, and this is universal, is we have got to keep our export markets open. That's extremely important for our farmers so that we have access to those markets. And because not only does that give them a place to sell their product, but it keeps the price high. So we avoid having to do a whole lot of subsidizing the price. The other thing we need to do is we need to maintain our infrastructure. Now, I visited Lock and Dam Number 8 down in southeastern Wisconsin, or southwestern Wisconsin, because we can move our farm products down there for half the cost of rail. So we also have to maintain our infrastructure. One thing that's been kind of surprising to me as I've gone around the state talking to farmers, there is no consensus in terms of what to do on subsidies. I mean, I realize from Economics 101, the farm economy doesn't work perfectly in a free market. You have a bumper crop, your prices tank, and you lose. You shirt, okay? So, you know, some level of subsidy, I think most people agree with. But I tell you, there are an awful lot of farmers I'm talking to that say, just get the government out of the way. We'll take care of ourselves. And another thing I want to point out is a pretty interesting discussion I had with, I think it was the Professional Dairy Producers of Wisconsin. And they were talking about, I'm not sure how many years ago this was, but dairy output in Minnesota and Wisconsin were totally equal. And Wisconsin chose the path of making the dairy industry more professional, doing things like hedging prices, really taking a look at the science of farming. Wisconsin has moved way ahead of Minnesota in terms of dairy output. So I think it's a very positive sign. I'll be highly supportive of our agricultural business here in Wisconsin. It's very important to do so.
Ron Johnson is a candidate for the United States Senate, a Republican candidate. He faces Dave Westlake in the September primary to see which one will move on to face off against Russ Feingold, the Democratic incumbent in November. Ron, thanks for taking the time to stop by WRN today.
Well, thanks for inviting me in.